This is an ESO and Dude Letter production.
Hey everyone, this is host Nick Kaufman from Dude Letter Podcasting and Myopia Defend Your Childhood. And I'm here to welcome you to the inaugural episode of our newest podcast, Mission Briefing. We're going to go using this podcast through every single one of the Bond movies, including the non-canonical Never Say Never Again. I hope you enjoy it as we start with Dr. No. Welcome to Mission Briefing. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to our first Myopia spin-off series, Mission Briefing. And today we're here to talk about 1962's Dr. No. I'm Nick Hoffman, host of Myopia and editor of Dude Letter, and our Bond panel is...
I'm John.
Matt.
And...
Mark.
Excellent. So today we watch the first canonical Bond film. And if you're tuning in and you're wondering what's happening, this is going to be a different series than our Myopia series. Myopia, we generally have someone who's defending a movie they haven't seen in 5 years that's at least 10 years old. But for this spinoff, we decided to do an entire series. And hell, if this works, hopefully we'll do other movie series in the future. But to start with, we're going to do all the Bonds in orders, inspired by our Pierce Brosnan month, which went from really good to really bad to so bad it's kind of fun pretty damn quickly. We decided to watch some classic Bond films. So before we get too far into this, as people who've watched all the Bond movies, where does Dr. No fit in for you? Matt?
So this is not one that I have watched many times. I haven't seen it more than once or twice. And I just remembered really odd things about it, which is not necessarily untrue. I mean, some of that, like the dragon scene I remembered and just some of the little parts of it. But it really... it's very different because they're clearly still figuring out what – I mean, they're obviously still figuring out what they're going to do with the movies. But some of the elements watching it, and I was like, wow, this is really a Bond element now. And other ones, you know, not so much. So,
fair enough. Mark?
I didn't see this until later. I grew up with a lot of Bonds, and then I came back and watched this one because it was the first one. I hadn't seen it, and I figured it would be good to – get the origin, you know? And from that perspective, it was kind of cool because you saw it stripped away of all the crazy space shuttles and lasers and doing backflips off of hovercrafts and stuff like that. which was kind of cool, but...
Fair enough. John?
Yeah, this one I must have seen maybe twice ever, and it was a long time ago. And honestly, until I watched it for this, I couldn't remember much about it except, well, I guess spoilers, but Dr. No dying.
Whoa!
Yeah, I know, right? And the dragon, which was, even when I was, what, like 8? I thought, this is a stupid, stupid prop.
They just, like, they grabbed an old BMP and, like, put some fins on it, and there's a dragon.
And they painted a face on it.
Yeah.
It's like, dragon, done.
That's probably a Chinese BMP, too. We should really look into this a little bit. But.
Yeah, no, I was baffled, too. I thought all of the villains ended up in Arkham Asylum.
Yeah, apparently not. Yeah, go figure.
Yeah, no, and as for me, like, so when I was young... And I was enamored with the Pierce and a few Roger Moore movies, right? I bought the first Bond DVD box set, and this came on it. So I was like, oh, this is the first one. I watched it with my dad, who had seen it in theaters back in 61. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is a movie I probably haven't seen in 15 years, because in some ways it feels extraordinarily 60s. Like, people aren't dressed crazy. And there's not, like, a psychedelic dance sequence, although there kind of is.
So.
But, like...
No go-go dancers, quite.
Yeah. If his character wasn't named James Bond and there wasn't Felix Leiter or M, you could convince me this was any generic spy movie from the 60s, almost. But like you said, some of it filters out and some of it really doesn't.
Yeah.
Let's get into the plot of this. John, what do you got for us?
All right, well, it turns out... finding a reliable plot synopsis online that's more than just a sentence is difficult. If I want somewhere between a sentence and a book, then I need to find a different resource for it. But so let's just go with IMDb. A resourceful British government agent seeks answers in a case involving the disappearance of a colleague and the disruption of the American space program.
Oh, that was succinct.
That's okay. Extremely succinct. Yeah. But I mean, for a more in-depth version, I guess a British operative in Jamaica goes missing, and James Bond is called out to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
While at the meantime, the American space program from Cape Canaveral is losing rockets, I guess, at this point. They're losing rockets. They're going down in the Caribbean for who knows what reason. So there's something going on in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And the death of this British agent is the reason James Bond gets sent to investigate. He does his investigations, and he comes across some double agents and things like that, typical James Bond stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he figures out that one island in the Caribbean is owned by a Dr. No.
The nefarious Dr.
No. The nefarious Dr. No. The secretive and nefarious Dr. No, who has a dragon and has some sort of death ray type thing.
It was like a radio.
It's a radio weapon. To disrupt the guidance, I believe,
I guess.
Of the rockets.
Yeah, yeah.
To throw them off so they would land.
For some
elsewhere.
Reason?
I have notes. It's called toppling.
Right.
Okay, toppling.
Bond. Well, I'm not an expert, but.
So.
Is this a scientific term?
Apparently.
I'm sorry, finish your synopsis.
Sorry. And anyway, he finds Dr. No. It's your very typical, or what I guess becomes typical, villain lair, an incredibly detailed underground lair full of like-dressed minions,
and a
doomsday weapon, and hotel suite, and whatever, and he ends up killing Dr. No, and they destroy the weapon.
Yeah.
There's so much here that I think is kind of fun to unpack, but for listeners at home, this is going to be different from myopia. Myopia, the idea is that we go in blind and we kind of enjoy this. This is well-researched and thought out. We have these worksheets that we've been working on. And so what I'm going to do is post online your empty templates so you can follow along with us. And ideally, we'll see, I'm going to upload our versions of these worksheets so you can figure out who has the worst handwriting.
Can I get some handwriting coaching over here?
I was going to say, mine is abysmal. I think the first thing we're talking about, which we should definitely get into here, is the classic starting to a Bond film, which is the musical interlude. So traditionally in a Bond movie nowadays, you have the cold open, which this movie doesn't have. We go right to the credits effectively. Mm-hmm. And then we have the Bond song followed by the Bond visual stimulus music video thing.
Mm-hmm.
This might be the way... Oh, and the shooting sequence.
Yes.
So Bond walks along, and I've done research. This is not Sean Connery doing this opening sequence. This is actually his stunt double who turns and does it. And they didn't bother to fix it. So for the first three movies, it's this guy wearing a hat that Bond does not have.
Now, may I ask, did Sean Connery need a stunt double to do this? I mean, it's kneeling and shooting.
Frankly, I'm trying to think of what scenes actually needed a stunt double, because I believe Sean Connery flipping half these guys. Like, because the fighting scenes, as Mark pointed out, is very 60s.
Yeah, it's got the double-handed ka-ka, stuff like that.
The equivalent of a judo chop.
Yeah, a judo chop here and there.
He did do some actual judo, though.
He did.
That, like,
yeah.
The throw and...
Yeah.
Which, in a way, always felt a little bit more realistic, because it's just guys rolling around on the ground instead of all this choreographed stuff, but... Yeah.
But we need to get to this kind of 1960s intro sequence. I want someone to try to describe this for someone who can't.
The flashing dots. I mean,
all the visual stimulus of dots.
And like some typography stuff going like, Doctor No! Doctor No!
It looked like that scene from, if you guys have seen Midnight Cowboy, where they're walking along a black scene and then like signs flash up around them. It's just like dots, 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 Doctor No! It could be a sequence from a Sesame Street short from the 70s.
Yes.
It's amazing.
It was probably the most 60s thing I've seen in a long time.
But it's so funny because nothing else in this movie screams 60s. No one had crazy lapels. There isn't a bunch of psychedelic music.
I don't know. Felix Leiter's sunglasses had to come.
We need to get to his Marilyn Monroe glasses. Because Matt and I watched this together. We looked at each other and were like, is this
it's like, A, is that Felix Leiter? Oh, no, it's really A, one of those glasses. B, is that Felix Leiter? So...
They also smoke like chimneys.
And they had selections of cigarettes. These are the Americans, these are the English, and these are the Turkish. And he's like,
So we did We did get a little bit of kind of something that turned into a Bond thing, where we got some silhouetted people, some of which were silhouetted girls, as part of the title song.
Yes.
And this title song was not a different song. It was just the Bond theme song.
But this is the first one, so you get to introduce a theme, which is fine.
Mm.
And it makes me wonder if the initial idea was, this is the Bond theme, or this is the new movie, so we just have, this is the theme, right? And then it just sticks. I like the theme. Don't get me wrong. I really like the theme. But this really screams like, if it were a Disney musical, this would be the theme song, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's the leitmotif, isn't it?
It's exactly what it is. And with the exception of something like Live and Let Die, where that theme comes up all the time, Bond is the ding-ding-ding-ding, ding-ding-ding, which is great. I don't know. It's just so goofy.
And but then they also like break into it, don't they? To
they
different
go,
songs,
the Three Blind Mice, like the Jamaican Calypso version, or
which fades right into the plot,
right? Yeah,
which is, that is not that doesn't happen often. The like three silhouetted men who then become the three assassins who are really in the kind of quote opening scene.
That was really cool.
I liked that. Yeah, and I, actually, it's one of these things where I've watched a lot of movies from the 60s that have held on, and it's actually interesting. We can get to this at the end, but whether or not if this wasn't a Bond movie, we would still be watching Dr. No. But, like, so many of them, you know, you want to show a lot about the movie in the title sequence, right? Like, it's almost like a series of posters, and if you watch a lot of the sword and sandal kind of movies that come out in the 60s, right, it's very dramatic poses of people coming over the top holding a sword or flexing. This is dots into three old blind people pretending to be blind, stumbling along as silhouettes. That's crazy. But we'll get to it. Sean Connery gets introduced as Bond here after about 7 minutes.
Yeah. He has a great introduction, too, and it's really something you would expect of Bond. I mean, he's playing Baccarat, he's seducing women, he wins a lot of money. Like, and he's very suave throughout the whole thing.
Well, and I was going to bring up, you know, I've seen the introduction of two Bonds live, Pierce Brosnan and Daniel Craig, and both of them have very dramatic entrances, right? Because Pierce Brosnan, we see running down a gang, like a dam, diving off of it in one of the most incredible live, I think at the time it set a Guinness record for the longest free jump.
Yeah.
Crawling through, like, a vent and then coming down and shooting a guy on the toilet. And he's like, hello. Right? Like, that's an incredible introduction. Daniel Craig is also very dramatic. This is, he's just at the table. He's like, I'm looking for Bond. And he's like, there, like, with a little cigarette dangling out of his mouth. As he lights it, he's like, of course. Like, it's just.
Well, his actual first line was Bond. James Bond. And I was like, hey, that's
perfect. Yeah. It's perfect.
It sets up the character perfectly. He's playing poker. He's
Baccarat.
Doing that. Baccarat. That game that only James Bond.
Can we get a round of Baccarat at some point going? I mean, I feel it's only fair that we actually play a game of it.
That needs to be
a paddle.
You got to have the paddle. Because you pass cards.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And you have to say, neuf à la banque.
And wit.
Wit à la banque. That's all we need to do. That needs to be our upcoming pro. Graphic designer Scott, listen to this bit. That's what we need. We need us all wearing, you know, tuxedos, gray-black suits with tuxedos, drinking cocktails, playing Baccarat.
Like, that's passing the shoe.
And for some reason, it's the only gambling game I can think of that has to exist only in French. Because he's in, I don't even know where he is at the beginning.
He's in London, isn't he?
Right? Yeah, and it's all in French. It's all in French. Why? Yeah. Poker can translate to languages.
Extra suave.
Yeah. He's an international man. Of
this.
He's okay. Importer exporter.
For universal exports.
For universal exports. Yeah.
Universal
yes.
exports, which also gets introduced here, which is great. Mm-hmm. Yes, we're just moving through the sheet. But I like how he's introduced here because it's actually – we have 6.5 minutes and I really had the pause. How long is it going to be before we meet Bond? It's actually nice and quick and it's successful. It works.
And I really liked it because we didn't get that many other scenes in this movie where Bond is like his real Bond element, like in the casino being – really gentlemanly, I guess, because he's not really gentlemanly.
Messing around, really. Because he's supposed to be a spy.
Yeah.
And he's just enjoying himself.
They do a pretty good job of establishing that, I thought, because he comes back to his apartment or room or wherever he's staying.
Which is probably the last time we see his apartment other than in the newest Bond.
Right.
We don't see much of it.
He immediately picks up that there's somebody there and, like, takes his shoes off because that's a spy thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Pulls his gun.
Yeah. He's on top of it.
He's well, actually a spy. Yeah, I like these early movies because they actually highlight the, like, he is a spy.
Well, and, right. it's incredible because he does detective work and he thinks of things, and it's so much of it really screams, I imagine what I'm like when I'm a spy. You know, like, it's because, like, he puts some sort of talcum powder on his briefcase so he can tell someone try to open it as though someone wouldn't notice that. Or he takes out a hair.
Puts it on the door.
Yeah.
I thought that was an awesome touch.
I really don't feel like that would work. I mean, we would have to test it ourselves. But, like, the second that hair dries out and there's, like, any sort of airflow in the room, I really feel that.
You'd probably have to glue it or something.
Yeah.
It is the 60s. There's probably not much air conditioning.
It's Jamaica, true. Too, so it's probably Jamaica. Pretty humid.
Yeah. moist air. Yeah, maybe Bond knows more than I do.
So what I'm going to have to do is we're going to have to break into Matt's apartment. And we're going to have to see if he can tell whether or not we were there. There's just talc on
well,
top
the lock
of the
is
mouse.
Busted. So.
So in case you're curious, we'll send you Matt's address so you can try to break in yourself.
But I also like that they sort of establish that when he comes back to the room in Jamaica and he checks all that stuff and he realizes, oh, somebody's been here. But he doesn't really react. He's just sort of like, okay.
It's almost expected.
Yeah. He just kind of – he gets a drink and then he stops and he's like, nope, not the open one. We'll get the fresh one. Because
oh,
it
we
might
need to
kill
get
him.
To that.
Yeah.
That is one of the
Bondiest of Bond moments.
Because what we have to remember that the cliche is that Bond drinks his martini shaken, not stirred, right? It's a vodka martini, light on the vermouth, right, with the lemon peel. Like, that's established right here several times. Mm-hmm. Yep. Nothing screams alcoholism like drinking just straight vodka on the rocks, but there you go. And yet, he thinks about it. He grabs a bottle of vodka that's on, like, it's like a side table with on a silver tray. He puts the rocks in it. And then he starts to pour, thinks about it, smells poison on the vodka, which makes you think maybe it's an actual spy trick because vodka has such a neutral smell, mm-hmm. right? Like it almost makes sense. And then in his desk drawer, he has another bottle of vodka. It's as though he's like, if I don't have sex or vodka every 6 hours, I'm going to die. I better have a spare.
Now, at the time, what was Smirnoff's reputation?
I don't know.
Does anyone have an idea on that?
Didn't really exist, I would think.
Was this their marketing thing? Like,
probably.
Introducing?
It's a damn good marketing technique. Yeah.
Well, and it's because it's so great. Like, nowadays, when we had that scene where, and it disgusted people, where Daniel Craig ordered a Heineken, people were like, yeah, that's exactly right. People were like, but he didn't ask for Smirnoff ever. It was just the vodka that they gave him for his room. It's a very subtle thing, and I like that. It works.
Much less subtle than the Red Stripe is.
To be fair, they're in Jamaica.
Yeah. I mean, if you're in Jamaica, you do as Jamaica do.
That's true.
As Jamaica do. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Smirnoff had existed forever, I guess.
Oh,
but
Smirnoff's British, apparently.
Now, I think. Right?
Yeah, now. Yeah.
I don't know. It worked very subtly here. For those of you, check your local library for more information on Smirnoff or your Wikipedia. So Bond gets called in to figure out what's wrong, right?
Yep.
The cold open is the three blind mice guys walk in. They wander in. They end up shooting
Strangway.
Yeah.
Who is the British agent in Jamaica.
Now, was that his secretary that they shot?
The one we see being shot is the one on the radio. Strangway was the fourth guy at that poker game, at the beginning, who wanders off, gets strangled, and killed in the car.
Yes.
They wander off, taking Strangway with him, right in the back of a car. The secretary is supposed to check in every X amount of hours, and because it's a movie, right as she's checking in, you hear, as she gets choked out, and someone breaks in the window.
She looks at the three windows. It's like, assassin, assassin, and another assassin.
And she, as a woman in a Bond movie in the 60s, she has no training, no button to hit to call the authorities. She just dies.
Apparently she's on the radio with the British government, and she doesn't bother to call for help. It's just radio silence.
And I will say, by this point in film history, we've realized that sometimes blood is semi-opaque. But this is Red House paint that is on her
like
shirt.
Like candy apple red.
It is brilliant.
Technicolor.
No. I was going to say, John beat me to it. We were talking about like whether or not planning this podcast, we're going to stream it, how we're going to watch these. John and I bought these Blu-ray sets to watch them because when you watch it on Blu-ray, there's no buffering and the colors are brilliant and bright. This is the most Technicolor movie I've ever seen, and you realize watching this on Blu-ray.
What about like, Technicolor Dreamcoat? I mean, that's
he wore a coat with golden lining. Nah. But, like, everything about this. At one point, even, I was pointing this out to Matt. You could see in the top right corner that the film strip was not up to snuff. And so it kind of blurred on the corners because it just, it was not even a good transfer.
Yes, it's towards the very beginning.
Yeah.
But, like, these movies are great. But, like, it makes all the things, like, the blood that they couldn't afford, that they realized on a bad 35mm print would need to pop. It's very clear that it's fake. And later when Sean Connery has been beaten up, crawling through the app, like crawling through things, you just see this kind of hole cut in his undershirt that's lined in cartoonish melted Crayola crayon red. Like, and he doesn't even have a wound underneath it for half of it. So the makeup guy stopped midway through. Like, it's amazing.
And he takes off a jacket, right? Like, mm-hmm. the jacket is on top of that. It isn't nearly as beat up. Because I remember him taking off the jacket, and I'm like, wait a second.
It's slightly tattered near the fringes, but the middle of his back, for example, is fine. Then he takes it off, and there's, like, a hole through his garment.
And I was watching it with my wife, and she very generously suggested that perhaps that's the undershirt he came in. That doesn't sound like Bond.
No,
all right.
No.
No, because you get the feeling that it, well, I imagine Bond in kind of a Steve Jobs, kind of like he has X amount of suits, X amount of undershirts, X amount of shirts. They're the same. He opens a drawer and they're all the same, right? Yeah. One gets torn. It's burned. He needs to look good. And he wore three beautiful suits in this. 1960s suits, man. I swear. We should talk about the things that make this movie like all the others just so people can compare.
I think the M intro scene is a good place to start.
Let's do it. Go ahead. Give me the M intro scene.
So this – he gets called in and, you know, down in Jamaica, we lost radio contact with them. It's been silent. But they do kind of – they introduce you to kind of what's going to be the routine for the rest of the intros where M gives him the mission. There's a kind of cue scene, kind of.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
And then Bond gets on his way. Essentially. I mean, that's kind of the formula for the beginning of the movie minus the cold open. So,
and we should point out here, because this is one of these things, like there's three characters here that we've introduced to already that have several versions. We have Q, but we don't really have Q yet. We'll get to Q with Desmond Llewellyn in the next movie. We have M, who always comes back and has been played by several actors and actresses.
Mm-hmm.
We have Moneypenny, and we have Felix Leiter. So, what did you guys think of Bernard Lee as M?
He's classic.
Yeah.
How can you not like
exactly.
Bernard Lee?
I really think of him as M just because I've seen so many of the movies with him. And I love, oh my God, I'm blanking on her name.
Judi Dench.
Dame
Judi Dench, yeah.
I really like her as well, but I've just seen, he's still M in my mind, I guess.
Well, because, go ahead, sorry, Mark.
Well, I was just going to say, it's like the 50s, 60s trope of the old man.
Yeah,
he's just sort of in charge of and he's in charge of the section or whatever the organization, and he's like a fatherly figure that just kind of dispenses with a little bit of keep your nose clean and investigate things.
No, that's exactly what I was going to say, because like Bond is the person who's wearing a classical outfit. Like, you know, Matt introduced the scene, but he comes in right out of the casino, so he's wearing this beautiful black tuxedo that if any of us were wearing today would still fit, because a man in a tux looks good. There's no crazy lapels. It's not outrageous. It's just nice and clean cut. Is sitting there in this chair, kind of frumpy with his pipe, wearing something that is slightly fashionable. It has even bigger lapels. It's 1960s-ish. And it's this kind of houndstooth pattern that you're just like, this is something his wife picked out for him. It's something that's like he got it like a department store, but a nice department store. But you're right. He's frumpy. He's the guy in charge. He's like, damn it, man. What are you doing? There's this – something happened in Jamaica. We want you to – why are you up at 3 in the morning is one of his lines.
Yes.
And Bond's like, well, I was at the casino.
I believe it was – I would never sleep on company time. Which I loved.
Which is perfect. And of course, Moneypenny's there who gets – I was going to say she doesn't get the time of day, because you could have told her it was, you know, 5 p.m. But we do get, before even to this scene, what I miss about Bond in the 60s, which is he comes in holding a hat, and we don't even see him. We just see him throw it on the hat rack and just nails it. It's the coat rack, but it's on top. And you're just like, this Bond knows what the fuck he's doing. It's so smooth. He comes in owning the room, and he gives Moneypenny this suave little look. This is when Moneypenny and him had a thing. And it's not... She even gets the line. She tops him, right?
I don't remember the line exactly. I'm sorry. I was trying to think of it.
No, but it's essentially like, you know, you wouldn't wear something like this to dinner or something. It was a dinner line, right?
It's something about never take me out to dinner or something like that.
Yeah.
And then he says something about government property, and I was like,
I
didn't quite follow that.
God damn it, okay. I should have spliced this in. But we're not going to, because I don't edit that way. Whatever. But no.
Why is she working at 3 in the morning?
I get the feeling that whenever something goes wrong, M calls her up, mm-hmm. which is perfect, right? It makes sense in that relationship, because this is a 1960s Bond. We'll get to, eventually, probably by next December... definitely by next December. I'm doing the math in my head. The new Moneypenny, which is an active agent in the field. This one is the secretary.
Well, I assume at that time you would have to have emergency plane tickets booked, hotel reservations, that kind of stuff, which at that time you had to have somebody actually doing that.
Yeah. Yes. You had to call to do it.
I would assume that's what she's doing.
And it's wonderful because she's actually an important part of the organization here. And that's, frankly, part of the problem in the 90s, right?
It's an interesting throwback to, I guess, the pre-digital age where you literally needed a secretary to get things done.
Right. As was that spiffy MI6 office.
Yeah.
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 With the leather door.
The double doors. Soundproof doors. Yeah.
And all those, like, fancy things, not exactly sure what they are. Lots of radio transmitters and receivers.
Well, I mean, like, we get introduced to MI6 because of it's like a bullpen. It looks almost as though they're filming like a newsroom, like a newspaper newsroom in the 1960s and 70s, but it's just filled with people on radios, like these giant boxes of radios, saying, "Why the Jamaica office didn't check in?" Like, it's amazing.
I guess it goes to show just what the reach of the organization is. If for people who aren't familiar with what MI, was it 5 or 6?
Six.
MI6? MI5 is the lower-level military intelligence. MI6 is the secret agents.
Right. So what they're doing on a global scale, that you've got a room full of people who are checking what Jamaica's doing every couple of hours.
Well, I'm assuming they're checking whatever.
Well, they're doing it around the globe. So you've got one guy for Hong Kong. You've got one guy for China. You've got one guy for Berlin.
And they also make that reference when he says if you... I forget what he's threatening him for doing, but he's saying he could put him back on normal intelligence duties.
Oh, yeah. And Bond's like, not accepting having a Walther PPK?
Right. That's what it was. Yeah.
I'll bust you down to looking at the radio.
So, as Mark did, segue, there's not a Q gadget here. The only Q gadget is that Bond has his old gun that he's had for the last decade.
He's using his child's toy of a Beretta, apparently.
Oh, you couldn't stop anyone with a Beretta.
I thought that was interesting, though, because the thing that picked up on that is that they mentioned that it's like throwing a brick through a glass window, and they say it's what the CIA uses. All the Americans are using it.
For the Walther PPK.
Which I thought was kind of telling in the very... sort of sign of the times thing, where it's like all of a sudden America is this big power on the political stage, mm-hmm. and we're going to do things like they do, which is apparently bricks through windows.
Which sounds about right. I mean, which is not the British way,
right? No. He had the Beretta, which was finesse, and he said he never missed. But they needed him to have stopping power, brute force.
Well, the only thing that M gets is that, remember that one time it jammed on you, James? And you're just like, fine, I guess.
And yet, he never missed with the Beretta, and yet the one time he actually uses the Walther, or one of two times he uses the Walther, he misses almost every single time.
He's trying to shoot the eyes out of the park.
He misses every single time.
That is very true.
I mean, it was a pretty fearsome dragon, so...
Well, yeah. I'm sure
everyone is convinced of.
Yeah, that's what they say about Jamaica.
Sorry, Honey Rider.
Honey Rider.
Wow.
Oh, we should mention the first Bond girl ever is he meets at the Baccarat table.
Sylvia Trench.
Sylvia Trench.
Oh, Sylvia Trench.
So right off the bat with the names.
Hey, what's that thing that women have? Trenches? Sure, why not?
Why not?
Octopussy is 5 years... Or, sorry, 20 years off at this point. But yeah, no. You know, is that the most English... Or sorry, the most British scene in this movie when Bond is told, no, 007... We never hear 007, by the way, which bothered me. But, no, Mr. Bond, this is a better handgun. And, like, the guy who's not Q, but kind of Q, comes in a wooden cigar box inside with a Walther PPK. He's like, yo, Beretta, couldn't stop anyone.
All important things in England are conducted via cigar box.
Clearly. I mean, that's an amazing scene.
And then he takes his Beretta with him when he
leaves. Yes, he hides it in the box. And M, smoking his pipe, is like, Mr. Bond.
You forgot something.
Yo, Beretta.
In that one scene, we know exactly what Bond is.
Yes.
He is a rebel. He doesn't like following orders, but he'll do it.
He'll do it.
He may do it grudgingly, but he'll do it.
I loved the first, you know, 15 minutes of the movie. Not that I didn't like the rest of it, but it really set up a lot of the character of Bond. I mean,
it was
really
a great
job.
Because you have, well, like we said at the beginning, there's not really a cold open, but there's about 7 minutes and change where there's no Bond. But it sets up the plot. You know, innocent. Secretary working for MI6 is killed. My goodness, what are we going to do? Well, we have to go to M. And M's like, my goodness, get me Bond! We actually... This is something that bothered me, but it's... So, Bond always runs this line between being the world's most famous spy ever. Like, as though there's a magazine called Spy Monthly, and Bond is on the cover every month. And being secret. This time, they play it both ways, and it's both awkward. Because when he's in the casino, the guy from MI6 is looking for Bond, and he gives the steward the card and says, give me Bond. Well, who should I say from? Just give him my card. Fine. Bond cashes out with Trench, Mrs. Trench. Miss Trench, sorry. Who likes golf and drinking and playing Baccarat. We'll get to the golf scene in a second.
And apparently breaking and entering.
And breaking and entering into a spy's apartment, which...
Always a good decision.
Yes. And, but Bond has a card with a phone number on it, which he gives to someone in this casino, in case you need to call Bond personally.
Master Spy, James Bond.
For all
phone
your
number address.
Needs.
Yeah. Bond, comma, James Bond, Master Spy, colon, phone number. Like, that's what it is.
He got his MS in spying at Oxford. He has credentials.
So, and then M chews him out, saying, it's 3 a.m, like we said earlier. He gets his mission briefing. Moneypenny is there, completely alert. 3 a.m, whatever. He goes back to his apartment to prepare, and that's where Miss Trench is waiting. And he goes, I have to leave immediately. And she's like, how soon? And then kisses him, immediately! And he goes, but how soon? Almost immediately. Which reminds me of how bad the theme song is played in this movie.
Relentlessly.
As the only music.
At inappropriate times, really.
Whoa. There is another song that gets used in this movie.
What
yeah, the
song
Three Blind
could that
Lights.
Possibly be?
Underneath the mango tree, my honey and me.
Which we only get in the Caribbean, to be fair.
To be fair.
It is completely inappropriate in England.
There's not. They don't have Mango Tree 1 in England. So Bond.
I still like that the woman Trench is completely nonplussed when Bond bursts into the room, like practically rolling through the door, and his gun is drawn, and she's like, "Oh, I was waiting for you."
No, and actually, credit where credit's due. This is one of the few times when Bond enters a room where he doesn't know what's going on. And I'm not talking about this movie, I'm talking about in future movies, right? Because usually when the woman is in the room, right, Bond might have the gun drawn, but sees her immediately and puts the gun back in the holster.
And he's very nonchalant about it.
Very nonchalant about it. This time, he does the thing where Sean Connery's a tall guy, right? So he kicks open the door and then immediately drops down to pull out his gun. Like, he's on his knee, like, in a firing stance. It's actually what someone who knows how to use a handgun would do, which we never see Vaughn do, unless it's a bad guy. This is one of the few scenes where it's actually a blind opening, and it works out. He doesn't shoot, but he actually has his gun drawn in a shooting position from one knee. Right? It's done right. Like, gun safety 101, man. Like,
again, it's what
training.
A spy would do, and which this movie kind of does.
She just says, oh, you've messed up my golf shot, right?
Yes, yeah. Because she's wearing one of his, like, shirts as, like, a sleeping blouse or something.
Yeah, what is this lady doing? She just helps herself.
And, yeah.
And not at all freaked out that he pulled a gun on her? Fine, I guess. I guess high-stakes baccarat in London leads to a lot of guns being pulled.
Maybe that's just a place where all the spies hang out. She's kind of like a spy groupie. But actually, I was looking things up for this, and apparently they were going to try to make that character like a recurring girlfriend for
really?
Bond.
You know, it's great that they didn't do that.
But it made almost no sense, like, without that, you were thinking, well, I guess they just threw some lady in to establish
that. I'm glad you brought that up, because aside from just introducing how suave he is, like, there was no point to...
Yeah, you kind of think, like, is she going to come back into this? She was, like, the master spy behind everything, and you're... But nope. Mm.
Well, no, and it actually sets up more of the actual character. Like, I get the... Again, it's what I joked about earlier. It's as though if every 6 hours he doesn't get laid or have Smirnoff, something's going to happen to him. Because he picks up women very easily, which you get as part of the spy game, but he beds people for no reason later on. In this movie, the two women he lays, is it matters. Like, they're important to the plot.
Excuse me, I believe there are three.
I'm sorry, I was one tick mark short on my... And in case you're curious, for those of you who haven't seen the sheet yet, it says, how many women does Bond 00?
We're classy like that. Yeah.
We're all 15-year-old boys secretly.
To be fair, what is the target audience of James Bond?
Oh, no. I'm not arguing with you.
What, men 15 to 70?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
I mean, considering that I'm 30 this year... two of us are older and one of us is much younger. Like, there's a reason why when GoldenEye came out in 1996 when I was 11, it all made perfect sense to me. I'm like, hey, hormones and Bond! Yay! That's why movies like Man with the Golden Gun sort of made sense but didn't. Because, like, Man with the Golden Gun, the women mean nothing to the plot, but they still show up at the end on the boat. Like, fine, why not? Made sense. We have barely gotten into the actual plot of this movie.
Well, the beginning was very dense as far as Bond character development goes, to be fair.
Because we were creating the character.
Yeah.
A lot of Bond firsts, which is one of our categories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bond first, and in fact...
Everything, really.
It's literally everything, comma.
We had the cards.
Universal exports. That's all I had.
I had cards, Bond, James Bond, Felix Leiter, he wears a tux. He gets the PPK. He later gets the villain plot over dinner... Because why not?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Crawling in vents. He does that a lot later. Secret lair.
And we were watching this, and by that point, John had showed up, and he's like, oh, so this is just Die Hard. It is. Like, well, and it's funny. This is something we'll get to as we move on. This Bond sets up so many things. And then by the 80s, some things are doing... So there, some movie series are doing Bond better than Bond, and so Bond has to adjust. This is why the series has lasted. Right? It's because it can fluctuate and move back and forth. And some Bond movies, frankly, are terrible. I like them because they're Bond movies, and that's why we're talking about Bond as people who liked Bond. But, yeah, in 20 years, 23 years later, when they do Die Hard, I'd rather watch Die Hard than this. But this beat it by 23, 24 years. That's amazing. This is a great scene. Sorry, go ahead. I see raised eyebrows.
No, it's a... I agree.
So we should talk a little bit about racism in this movie.
of which there was none, right?
Oh,
none.
Absolutely
this
not.
This is clean. I don't know. I mean, no one was pretending to be Chinese when they were English.
Never.
I felt they really asked Coral, who we haven't actually talked about yet.
Okay, please. Give me a Coral as a Bond character, baseball card style. Just like, what does he do? Who is he?
So Coral is like... he's introduced, and then Felix is like, oh, yes, this guy has been helping us. So he's kind of like a liaison. He knows the local scene. He knows what's going on. He's a fisherman. Yeah, he's the local help. But I felt like they asked Quarrel to do, like, a lot of things.
Yeah, was he getting paid?
I don't know.
I would certainly hope so.
Because they're like, Quarrel, go get that woman. It's like, well, why don't you get the woman?
I like, they do give him an out. They say, no, no, we can get ourselves there just to let us know how to get there. And he says, no, I use my senses, my eyes, my ears, and my nose.
Well, and then later they paint him as, like, a random drunk. Like, oh, you Quarrel, drinking all that rum.
Yeah, random scenes that have nothing to do with anything. And he's just drinking from a barrel of rum.
Well, I guess between him, Felix Leiter, and Bond, he's the comic relief. I mean,
well, he'd have to be, yeah.
And it's so weird because he's almost also asked to be, like, give me every stereotype of fear, right? Because like he's the first one who's like, there's a dragon, and you're just like, wait, what?
Excuse me.
It's not even it's not even convincing. Like, it doesn't even have a Chinatown parade kind of dragon look to it. It's a bad car. It looks more like
go Google a BMP-1 and then put some fins on it and like a little slope here, and there's your dragon with a mouth.
And if you're drunk and lazy like most of us here, it looks like the car from the end of Animal House that ruins the parade.
It does, yeah.
It even has the teeth. Like, that's clearly what they were basing
it
on.
But the problem is, I don't think it's just him, because Honey Rider says, I saw it too, and she described it.
To be fair, she does come off kind of stupid.
Oh,
I thought.
Well, yeah, you mean women deserve to be in the home with the kitchen on and an apron? And
I read through the encyclopedia. I got to T. Mm-hmm. What are you talking about?
No, no.
I
know. From she age started eight. With A right. And A
It doesn't take that long. Come on.
Well, if you're really absorbing the knowledge, that could take a long time.
Would
you be at T yet?
What's his name? A.J. Jacobs read the whole encyclopedia in a year, right? Encyclopedia Britannica in a year for that book, A to Z.
I'm not familiar. I'm sorry.
Wow, yeah.
AJ Jacobs is a guy who just does experiments. Like, I'm sorry. But no, it's stupid because,
to be fair, this is a 1960s Encyclopedia Britannica, which would presumably be much shorter than it is currently.
And also, unlike I don't even know where I'm going with this. It's stupid because it makes no sense. Her father was a doctor in marine biology, right? She traveled the world with him looking at shells. And she's like, I educated myself. I didn't go to school. Because Bond asks her,
yeah.
Well, where did you go to school? It makes sense. Your father was a professor or whatever. And she's like, I didn't go to school. I learned by reading the
shells are all that there is in the world.
Shell is worth $50. Well, fine. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Let's just say it doesn't set the trend well for strong female characters.
No.
Thank God Natalia shows up in
the movie. To be fair, I mean, she pulls a knife.
Yeah.
Eventually. Yeah, eventually.
Considering she's introduced to him when he's pulling a gun on her, and she's like, I have this knife.
And you know what? She actually handles her own, more or less.
She does.
I mean, it's set up that...
Does she really? Seriously? You just said that? Really?
Well, it's set up that she's been coming to this island, been evading them as they've been looking for her. So
but then even she says she evaded them enough that they stopped bothering.
But that means she must be at least somewhat useful.
She was cognizant that they had radar, which, according to Felix, is totally legal and not anything conspicuous at all.
And detects boats?
What?
Like little tiny boats?
Not her boat. Her cigar ship with the sail. Fine.
Whatever.
Mark.
Yeah.
I don't know. So eventually Bond gets through Jamaica. Let's build up to where she is.
Yeah.
Gets to Jamaica, realizes that something is happening on this one island. What was the name of it? Anyone write that down?
Crab Island.
Crab Key.
Crab Key. Okay. Yeah. Where that's where the professor was, who was playing the bridge game, that was actually the secret agent, Strange something.
Strangeway.
He was pretending to be a normal guy with a hobby in geography. Or, sorry, geology. And disappeared one day from this one bridge game, which was the cold open, kind of. But Bond goes to investigate, realizes that whatever he was investigating on this island had something to do with weird soil samples. The weird soil samples turned out to be radioactive. And he takes them to his buddy, a Professor Dent. Not Harvey Dent. He's not Two-Faced, but I wish he was.
He is Two-Faced.
He's pretty Two-Faced. Yeah.
Oh. My word. Hey. My monocle just fell into my martini. And he ends up being the kind of Bond, like the villain henchman. And as far as henchman goes, he is the worst, most ineffectual henchman because he looks baffled all the time. He has the high cheekbones that make you suspicious naturally. And the second he gets a gun, well, he tries to kill Bond. And has Bond has one of my favorite lines of this movie. It's one of the few quips.
Oh, yeah.
And it's where we get an Archer-ish scene where Archer... The whole joke is that Archer is a brilliant alcoholic savant. And the one savantish thing he gets is counting bullets. Right? And this is the thing, right? Because Bond, after dispelling of... we didn't even really get into her, but the secretary.
But he did.
Whoa! Whoa! What was her name? I didn't bother to write
her. Are we ever actually introduced to her?
I'm sure we are, but it doesn't matter.
Probably, this is my secretary, blah, blah, blah.
This is my secretary... Fairly mildly Asian woman who's actually English playing an Asian woman.
Right. Look at her hairdo. She's so Chinese.
They dyed her hair black, put it up as Chinese, and drew eyelashes with really bad makeup to make her look vaguely Asian.
You can't find an actual Asian.
She rocked the terry cloth top, though. Yeah.
She had the Asian top, but you pointed this out. She's listening through an ear hole, the keyhole.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so describe the scene.
Well, Bond is talking to, I guess... The local...
The section chief.
The section chief. So the Jamaica head of the Secret Service. And he's doing his whole thing, getting the rundown on what's going on. He leaves through the back door and finds this woman, who is presumably the secretary of the section chief, practically, literally, with her ear up against the door.
And it's as though to say that Asians are just sneaky people. Because
it's
why would
like
you hire one in Jamaica?
All the time. Yeah.
Because the whole time it's like, we can tour all these little coves and islands, except for this one that's owned by the Chinese.
Right, and they had the whole thing with Professor Dent, right?
Yes.
Who,
yeah.
And it seemed really unnecessary, because it was pretty blatantly obvious that if you were going to check one place, it was going to be Crab Key.
But how does Bond know that Professor Dent is suspicious? Do you remember this?
Because... Bond gave him, like, rocks or something from...
He gave him the receipt from the sample that the guy submitted to the lab. Yeah.
And Dent said they were just normal whatever-the-hell rocks, and apparently they were radioactive.
Oh, no. There's something even before that that's even more subtle and stupid. Incredibly stupid. But Bond
that
goes...
That fits in with the theme of this movie, really.
But Bond shows up to the section chief guy, and he's like, well, can you introduce me to these guys, whatever, the three other guys who play bridge, or two other guys who play bridge, other than you and the guy who died? And he's like, of course, you want me to call them in? He's like, no. Introduce me socially. And he goes, sits down with them, and they're all drinking cocktails and talking about the guy who's disappeared. Oh, my goodness, what happened? He goes, well, he had a pretty hot secretary. And then Vaughn goes, oh, that secretary. He was the only one who bothered to mention the secretary on the weekends. And he's just like, of course Vaughn notices that. And that was supposed to be subtle. It was the least subtle plot point of all.
No. Well, everybody is subtly the worst liar in the world in this one, because the secretary that's listening through the keyhole says, oh, I was just, I dropped these files and I needed to pick them, not listening, no, at all. Everybody's terrible at lying in this.
And like, she's sent to fetch the files on Dr. No when Bond is meeting with the section chief.
Yeah.
And she comes back and says, no, they're gone, sorry. I mean, we saw in the death of Strangway's secretary that the assassins took the file.
Right.
Which presumably is the same file. I thought it was.
Yeah, that's what I assumed too.
And she comes back and says, they're not here, sorry. If she's an agent for Dr. No, why couldn't she do that herself?
Or why doesn't she just say, we lent them to Strangway, and when he disappeared, so did they? That's the easiest answer. Why lie at that point?
We know almost as soon as we're introduced to her that she's a spy, a double agent.
Because she's supposed to be Asian, which we might have recognized had it been 60 years ago when this was not offensive.
Yeah, apparently this is England versus China, the movie.
It's their version of, I was going to say War Games, I was going to say Red Dawn. It's their version of Red Dawn. Much more baffling, but like, my word! ultimately, this convinces Bond to go see this one island. Coral, who almost beats the crap out of him, then realizes, oh, he's okay, thanks to Red Stripe.
And this is my favorite line of the movie occurs. So we have the owner of the bar, Pussfeller.
Pussfeller, yes.
And Bond gets... What was it?
Because that's a name.
It is a name. So
Pussifer, which we thought it was.
Coral leads him into the back room, and he's like, it's more private to talk in here. And then Pussfeller, you know, comes in the room with a gun, and then Bond disarms him, and then Felix comes in behind him. But after this little altercation, Bond says, I hope he cooks better than he fights. And Pussfeller says, well, no one dies from my cooking.
Which is such a... So much of this movie you could convince me was bad improv, but that one is like, give the guy a line. Come on, there's one line.
The line you were getting to when Dent comes in and tries to kill him.
Oh, please.
Was, yeah, he never said it yet.
He shoots at the bed, which has been made to look like Bond is in it because he knew that he was coming, and he gets his gun back and pulls it on Bond and goes to pull the trigger, and it clicks, and he says, that's a Smith & Wesson, and you've had your six, and then awesome, which is a great one.
Yeah, that gets a star. And the other part of that scene which deserves a star is Bond knowing he's going to die and being okay with it, right? Because what he does is he's like, well, this guy broke in before, clearly, because he set up the hotel, like Matt mentioned earlier. So he knows someone's going to come back. Like, he's a spy. He gets this. So what does he do? He pours himself two shots of Smirnoff. Again, Smirnoff. Prominently labeled Smirnoff. And get drunk. Takes out a deck of cards and starts playing solitaire with himself. Knowing that eventually someone's going to come in. And he has his Walther on the table. And then all of a sudden he hears the click of his front door. So what does he do? Turns the lights down and just waits. He pulls it. You see the shadow come across there. That is a perfect Bond scene to me, yeah. Because the idea that in some of the later movies, like we even see it sort of with Pierce in like the World Is Not Enough, where he's like, he sits in the chair with a bottle of Smirnoff waiting. But the idea is this guy might never show up. Ergo, I need something to do with myself. So he busies himself with Smirnoff, like with the solitaire, the Smirnoff. It's a perfect Bond scene.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say, if you're handling a weapon in anticipation of an assassin, getting drunk is probably not the best way to do it.
I'm going to interrupt you there and say, do you think two shots of Smirnoff would get Bond drunk at this point?
I think a whole bottle of Smirnoff would not get him drunk.
So he's fine.
He's
well
got
done.
A liver the
That's
size of a raisin.
Safety 101. But like you said, that's such a great scene because he goes, drop it. After he shoots six times, like shoots the pillow, which is supposed to be Bond, he goes, drop it. Bond sees him. He goes, give me the plot synopsis so far because I've been drinking. I don't know what's going on. And he tells it, and he drops it on this comforter that's on the floor. And the whole time, Professor Dent is pulling it towards him slowly, slowly, slowly. He grabs the gun and shoots.
Very
and
inconspicuously, mm-hmm. by
it's
the way.
So well done. And he thinks, because Bond keeps turning away and lighting cigarettes or whatever, but Bond has played the game. It's one of the few times we really get, like, one of the lists I'm going to make throughout this whole podcast is things that Bond knows. We already mentioned toppling. But Bond...
Amateur rocket scientist?
Question mark? Analyses? But, like, it's one of these things where Bond's like, looking at the gun very quickly. That I believe he was trained on, right? Just like the old, you pointed out, it's like an MG40 later on.
I think it's an MP40, the gun.
MP40, yeah. Yeah. He's like, well, that's how many clips it would, like how many he'd shoot, because he knows how to play that game. I believe he's trained in weaponry. The idea that later he can fly every vehicle ever made, question mark? But seeing that it's a Smith & Wesson... Also, something that someone who has never seen this movie before and watches, you will be disturbed, at least, and I noticed it right away, at how a silencer sounds. Because these clearly were actual silencers, as opposed to the ones in the 80s and 90s would make that pew kind of whistle noise. They didn't have that. It was actually just a muted shot, which...
It was like a thud, wasn't it?
It was a thud, which is how silencers work. They don't actually sound like a laser beam from Moonraker, which we'll get to, trust me.
Must we? Really?
I like Moonraker.
Yes,
that was my favorite when I was a kid. I was like, space
yeah,
and lasers!
Kid, then you watch it now and you think, ooh.
Then I was like, hey, GoldenEye, which is, or a gold, Man with a Golden Gun, which is like a made-for-TV movie. Mm-hmm. And I really do like GoldenEye, even still.
One more quip I had that I liked. It was very Bond. When he's going up to the secretary lady's apartment, he gets a tail in the car, It's I guess the three blind mice.
Yeah.
In the hearse. Guys in the hearse. And they're trying to run him off the road on these dangerous mountain roads in Jamaica. And he, at the last second, finds a crane or something that's pulled off to the side. And he, in his little car, is able to go whoop, right underneath. And the hearse has to, oh, crap, and steer right down the mountain. And it goes down and down and explodes
for
and catches on fire.
35 minutes.
And the guy who's working on the truck that stalled out says, what happened there? To which he says, I think they were on their way to a funeral, which is so very Bond.
So fun fact, that hearse swaps models after it goes off the cliff.
Really?
What?
Yes.
Uh-huh. How did you notice this?
I looked it up. I did not notice it. But,
to the internet.
Yeah. Swaps models after it, you know, crashes and burns. So, or wallets crashing and burning.
I think, I don't know where this falls on the actual list of things we have to talk about, but the car, apparently it's a Chevy that Bond is driving the entire time.
I looked it up quickly.
Do you have the website open? So the thing is, one of the things we were expecting, okay, there's this one scene in the lobby of the hotel Bond is staying at, and the, I don't know, she was at the hostess desk, whatever. She goes, there's a new car for you. It's in lot 5. And I was like, it's going to be the DB5. It's going to just show up. And it didn't. And I was very upset. We ended up with another...
It's like a blue pill-shaped thing. Yeah.
it's a car that looks
like... It's very disappointing as far as cars go.
It's like a Chevy Nova or something. It's atrocious. It's a car that shouldn't exist in real life.
Yeah, we looked it up earlier and it just looks... It's a Chevy something, isn't it?
Well, it's one of these times where there's really not a Bond gadget. There's not a really fancy car. Like John said at the top, it's as though they made this whole movie on the super cheap. Like, and I mean, they probably did. Who knows? Like, there's so many.
It's an old Chevy Impala is what he was driving.
An Impala?
Yeah, a 59 Chevrolet Impala.
My wife used to own one. They didn't, they were not that small. They were never that small.
I believe.
They obviously reinvented it.
I may be incorrect.
Sometime after the 50s.
Well, if you're angry at us, send your emails to Matt.
I was expecting the Aston as well. I would have done more car research ahead of time.
At least a British model, but I guess at this point it was, we'll take what we can
Jamaica.
Get.
You're in Jamaica.
Yeah,
I guess they can
be
American.
And to be fair, all of the vehicles looked like they were in, you know, late 50s, early 60s Jamaica.
But even Jamaica, it's a British colony at this point. It may have been just like a recent... independence, whatever. But they still drive on the left side of the road.
Yes, they did.
So a American Chevy presumably would have still been a right side driving.
Mm-hmm. We should accelerate a little bit.
This is a different topic. This is a different topic.
We've been talking almost an hour. We haven't even gotten to Dr. No yet.
Oh, God.
Or the plot. Or anything the plot. Else, really.
Well, I mean, we touched kind of on the plot. Okay, so long story short.
What is exactly the villain's plan?
I don't know. It seems to be pissing off NASA, frankly.
That was one of our prompts, and it said, what is the villain's plan? And I put rockets, Spectre,
He's downing American moon rockets, apparently.
Well, this is 61. I imagine they're going to...
They said it was Mercury on
they're
the
unmanned.
Over.
Yeah.
So on like the TV station when they're watching when they're going to intercept it at the end. But mm-hmm. And I think it was M mentions that, these crazy Americans with their rockets, they try to land one of the... South Pacific, but it ended up in Brazil or something like that.
Right.
I don't know what that really accomplishes. I guess it's like, here's mud in your eye, America, with your stupid rockets.
I know what that's a reference to. Isn't it Liberty 7 that ends up like way off course?
Oh, is it actually?
I have no idea.
Okay. No. I mean, so something that the Bond movies always do is reference current events. Like the one that just came out, of course, when we're recording this is Spectre. So it's all about NSA, effectively. Right, like everyone listening in, which has been like really intense news.
Oh, should watch it.
But regardless, you know, 1957, it's Liberty 7, which is one of the early Gemini rockets, ends up hundreds of miles off course. And they find him eventually. Of course, John Glenn doesn't drown, but like he ends up way off course because he's distracted by things. And I mean, like if it's going to the moon, it's probably a later Gemini rocket, and they're trying to do the where they go around the moon before they get to Apollo, right?
Yeah, I didn't see the next dot in that.
Oh, no, like, I'm not arguing with you. It's not explained, but it's kind of like Spectre's going to disrupt this. Why?
Because all the other ones, it was like, I'm going to irradiate all the gold so that I have
Well, even in Dr. No's like big speech thing where he's more or less explaining it to Bond, and we find out that he's part of Spectre, and just that Spectre is an actual acronym.
I know.
Yeah. A clever one, too, right?
Special Executive for Counterintelligence, Terrorism, Revenge, and Extortion. I looked that up thanks to Wikipedia.
Revenge, yeah.
Because Dr. No looks directly into the camera and says all of that.
That's how you know this is an important scene. But even he says something to the effect of, we're going to do this, and then we'll just burn this island, and we'll move on. It's like, well, why are you doing this then?
Well, you get the sense, at least I got the sense, that it's sort of some part of some master plan that we aren't supposed to be privy to.
The problem is we never actually get privy to this.
But that's,
it just sounds like
it's all Spectre's big shadowy organization.
Kind of a dick
something.
Thing to do. It's so. Just for the sake of it. Which I guess if your motive is revenge in your name, then I'm sure someone has some sort of idea for it.
But John, are they on the side of the East or the West?
They're either on the side of the East or they're on the side of America, which is which is the dichotomy in this movie. It's not the East and the West. It's not America and the Soviets. It's not capitalism and communism. It's like the United States and the East.
Question mark.
Just the generic East. Thus all the vaguely Chinese people in the movie.
Exactly.
Not even Asian. It's just, what do we call it? Yellowface.
Yellowface. Yeah, because there's no Chinese. There's a couple Chinese extras playing like security guards and like muscle, and in the decontamination bay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But even they don't have. They're not speaking Chinese. There's no subtitles. They don't even have Asian accents. They're English people who are occasionally putting on an affectation of Asianness.
Honestly, it's ridiculously American accents. Like, yes. The guy on the boat who's talking through the megaphone. Who I've said before,
right.
is my favorite character because he's so blatantly dubbed that even when he's not talking through the megaphone, his voice sounds like he's talking through the megaphone.
What was that accent? It sounded almost like...
It's super American.
I know.
It's
it was
crazy.
Like gangster or like New York or something. I don't know. Like it was bizarre because we're in Jamaica and they have
at
coral.
Least give a Jamaican accent or
right.
something.
We never filmed in like Miami, Florida. It's Jamaica and Pinewood in London. So they found someone who's like, can you do a Jamaican accent? I can do an American accent. Fine.
Close enough.
No one sounded like Bob Marley here.
Which is actually a good thing.
Thank God. Yes. Thank God. Because it would have been the most offensive white guy playing Bob Marley ever. Eventually, we end up on that island, Dr. No's Island, where they run across Ursula Andress playing Honey Rider. That's where Coral immediately becomes the most stereotypical character, which throughout the entire time before this, he really hasn't been other than not wanting to go to the island.
But now he's a useless drunk. Yeah,
up until this point, I was thinking, this is a really good character, like as a sidekick
and
type character. He's pretty good.
Blame him for not wanting to go to the island. I mean, okay, yeah, the dragon's not very convincing, but if you're just a fisherman and there's like some spies and they're like, hey, bring me to this island. They've got like armed guards and radar and all this other stuff. Like, I would be not too interested.
Well, and as Ursula Andress says, no one has made it back alive. Like, everyone dies on this island, right?
Right.
And she's the only one who's been able to get in because they're apparently she can outrun them, question mark?
Something.
On a sail ship? On like a little cigar boat that's a sailboat? Fine, whatever. So she's stealing shells. Bond comes across her and he's like, drop that bikini, which she does, and just wears a shirt that's completely see-through on the Blu-ray.
Thank God.
Thank God. And then the movie just kind of gets slows back down. Something for those of you who have not watched a lot of movies from the 60s, especially spy movies from the 60s, there's maybe four people Bond kind of beats up before he gets to the island. It's a very slow-paced movie, considering it's only an hour and 48 minutes long. It's very paced.
Yeah, he really doesn't actually kill too many people, unless you count, like, everybody that dies when they blow up the place at the end. But there's
all of the following fallout from that. I mean,
right, yeah,
but we don't
everybody
even
that
see that many people die. The only person we really see die is Coral, who gets emoliated. So, okay, we need to get to this. But to your point, Bond has a gun that he uses only to shoot out the eyes of this dragon car.
Right.
But he doesn't really use the Walther on anything.
He, what is he? The guy that tries to abduct him at the beginning kills himself with the
cyanide.
The cyanide capsule. He runs the other three blind mice off the mountain, and they die in the hearse.
Yep.
And of course he kills Dr. No himself. But other than that, you really don't see him.
And actually a pretty good scene. Like, Doctor knows death matters because so few other people really die. Like, I'm not saying that Bond didn't kill the people in the hearse, for example, because he did. But it's not like Bond there with a gun, execution style, shooting them or even distance shooting them. Like, later, Bond becomes this magic bullet guy who can just kill anyone with a single shot. And if he has 8 bullets, he's going to kill 7 people.
Or 9. Yeah.
Or 9. But, like, here, Bond is all physical. And I believe that Sean Connery, as the tallest person in this movie, who's pretty beefy, can really throw people out of cars and buildings and things.
And at this point, it's kind of like James Bond is one part naval officer, like, and gentleman.
Yeah.
And then one part almost detective. Alcoholic. And then one part commando.
Well, they call him a policeman. Dr. No calls him a policeman, which I was telling Nick earlier that I'm pretty sure that, like, Blofeld and some of the other villains call him a policeman in subsequent movies. Because he's the strong arm of the British government.
Yeah.
He's enforcing their law.
Detective work. Exactly. There's a lot of detective work.
This is like a spy, and the license to kill is like is your last resort kind of thing. Your first duty is to find out what's going on.
Interesting, though, because it was the difference between, like, the modern Bonds that are like an operative, whereas Sean Connery Bond is like a commando in, like, the 60s. It's like
a detective.
The one other guy he kills when they're hiding in the river with the snorkels made of the reeds, which I guess wasn't cliche at that point. I don't know.
I'm hoping it wasn't.
Because that was a really awkward scene.
He sneaks up behind the guy with a knife and grabs him, puts his hand around his mouth, and I guess knifes him in the back.
Which we see no blood, no knife even.
Which is a total, like, commando from the World War II kind of move, rather than, like, operative. Like, he doesn't sneak up and get his neck with a quick, which, like, break the neck, and it doesn't have that, like, ninja aspect to him.
Well, and to fill this out a little bit, Ursula Andress is getting shells, like we mentioned before, honey is, and she has this huge kind of knife on her hip, which you would use to do, I don't know, murdering a sea lion.
Open shells.
Yeah. No, yes, but when you're underwater, you don't open the shells. You open them above ground.
There are sharks in the water.
I mean, no, it's fair.
It's
a diver's knife. It is a diver's knife. And she has goggles which appear and disappear depending on the scene. But she pulls a knife on Bond. Bond has his handgun, but he puts it away. He's like, oh, she's a woman. She won't hurt me.
Harmless.
A warship comes by. Bond can tell by the engine. Quarrel shits himself and hides behind a sand dune. They hide. They fire some rounds at them, yada, yada, yada. But that night, when they try to make a break for her hiding place, they bring dogs and all this crap. It's a weird 10-minute, 15-minute segment where they're trying to get to the secret place. Fine. Long story short, they end up in this swampish thing, and this dragon shows up, and it's a car, and it's the worst quote-unquote dragon. Unbelievable. Matt brought this up, and John brought this up as things they remembered from a kid. I forgot this scene completely. It's the worst thing I've ever seen.
I remember it being stupid, and it was stupid.
Nailed it.
Yeah.
I kind of wonder what it was thought of at the time, because certainly looking at it now, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
It is literally like a car with a metal plate on it, with a mouth painted on it.
If you asked a kindergartner to draw a dragon car, that was this car.
Exactly.
Yes.
It's like a bad Scooby-Doo villain.
Exactly. And even there was a sign when they knifed the guy, there was a sign that they obviously walked past that the camera panned to that said, like, danger, do not continue.
But it looked like it was drawn on, like, it was...
Yeah, it was very Scooby-Doo. Yeah. Well, this is an island of misfits.
Cartoon skull. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Bond and Bond heads as Walther, and Coral has some sort of revolver. It looks like a Colt. And they're trying to, he says, like, you shoot out the whatever, and I'll shoot out the eyes and the tires. And the eyes are these spotlights, and the tires are these huge giant tires because it's this enforced car thing. It is a car with teeth drawn on it, eyes that are these headlights, like I said, and a flamethrower out of each corner of the front of the hood. Coral gets cooked alive.
Which was pretty brutal, actually. I mean, so much out of contrast with the rest of the movie.
He screams, and you just see this arm sticking out that's, like, on fire.
You see a burning corpse. Mm-hmm. And it was, I mean, it wasn't super graphic, but like person on fire writhing on the ground.
Plus, he's
like,
not a spy again. He must be getting paid pretty damn good.
His role is always questionable, and he's a ship captain. Like that's it.
He's a fisherman that just got bored, I guess, and now he's getting roasted.
Now he's like immolated on the ground.
Right.
I mean, he's just dead.
I mean, that escalated pretty quickly.
And eventually, they capture Bond, and there are these people in these radiation suits. This bothered me slightly. They're in lead-lined kind of teal radiation suits. And the idea is that they're being irradiated where they are because they get taken into Dr. No's base. And you have people walking down long metal hallways. You have these kind of things. Okay, fine. They're taken into this like entryway that looks like a garage. And they have Geiger counters. And they're like, well, she has 75 blah, blah, blahs. And he has 81 blah, blah, blahs. But, and then Bond goes on later to say, you've clearly understood nuclear energy and it's so safe on your island. If you're being irradiated on the beach near a nuclear power plant, that's not controlling radiation. That's terrifying.
No. They said that they were found in the swamp. So, effectively, we think that they're irradiated. So the swamp must be something like a reservoir or something where
waste dumping ground.
Exactly, yeah. The waste has to go somewhere, so I guess the swamp is where it goes.
And I guess the suits are the suits that keep you from,
I guess,
being exposed to like the alpha.
Because the guys outside weren't dressed in the suits. The guys inside were.
But the guys in the dragon were dressed in radiation suits, although...
But the dragon is by the swamp, so...
I did point this out. If you watch the scene carefully, they get taken into this garage area for decontamination, but the guy, there's a security guard without a radiation suit just walking around in the background of that scene, so he's fine.
Oh, Bob.
Also, this is a weird scene because clearly on 35 millimeter you can't tell the detail, but essentially they're told to strip naked to be decontaminated. So they go through this car wash, and it looks like a Hot Wheels car wash where there's these steps and they're like, radioactive, radioactive, less radioactive, less radioactive. But Ursula Andress comes off at the end, and she's completely naked, and you can just see her naked for like a second and a half because this is the 60s, and I guess they didn't bother with that.
I don't think she was completely naked.
I'm pretty sure you could. We'll check it with Dr. Reginald's skin later.
Science demands that we look into this.
Yeah. But, this is effectively where we need to get to the end. Not to the end of this because we don't have more time, but this is where the Bond movie becomes like cliche Bond movie again. We're on this island that's in this nuclear power plant base because nuclear power apparently can power the Doppler radar laser thing that can dislocate the Nassus at Cape Canaveral.
It's the precursor to Doppler.
Doppler, yes.
And there is no other way to power a radio transmitter,
laser,
nuclear power. Yeah,
I'm not going to argue with you because it's science. Bond and her and Honey end up in this. Again, this is where Bond cliches come from. It's this beautiful, looks like a. Bond even says first class service. It's like a 5-star hotel suite. There are no door handles. There's no windows. He points out. He's like, you've been tired. You've been up all night. So have breakfast. And the coffee is drugged! Exclamation point.
Which is coffee!
Sort of out of character, but sort of in character that he's, oh, okay, we're being civilized now, so I'll be civilized and whatnot. But at the same reason, like, you saw him come home to his room there, and he switches the bottles of vodka. And here he's just like, oh, okay, coffee. Pfft.
And she drinks first, and she's like, I feel funny. And Bond's like, wait, what? The coffee! And he throws the glass down, and it breaks, and it's so cartoony.
I still don't understand why. Because right. They're in a jail cell.
What
why knock them out?
They just accomplish?
No, and it was my thought, too, because I didn't say this, but I was my snide comment was going to be, well, of course Bond knows that it's fine, because if he was going to kill them, he would have killed them earlier. And then she goes, I don't feel well. I'm like, well, shit, it was actually poison.
That would have been the smart thing
both
to do.
Of them.
Yeah.
Well, so that later he can put them in their beds and then creepily move the...
Yes! Oh, my
right?
God!
Yes.
So they pass out on the floor. Like, she passes out on this, like, kind of double couch. And he falls on the floor, like, propping himself up after shattering the coffee cup. I don't know why there was also food. They should have just been the drugged coffee, but why not? The next cut, it's asleep. And he's tucked into bed all cozy, and you're just like, Wait, what?
And Dr. No comes in, and it's a shot where we don't actually see his face. We,
but we see
his
this
feet.
Black leather glove. He's wearing this kind of beige tan linen suit, and there's this black leather gloved hand that's tucking him in, and it's very, it's oddly sweet, and kind of like, wait, what?
It was very, a little odd, yeah.
I wasn't clear on that. It almost seemed like he was testing the sheets to see if, like, is Bond actually passed out?
That was one of his Q inventions, like, these sheets will restrain Mr. Bond for the next 6 hours.
I don't know, it was weird.
So they can join him at dinner, which we don't see any of dinner other than three olives on Bond's plate and someone pouring him champagne.
Right. It's an English breakfast.
another quip I had when he was going to break the bottle and attack everybody. Bond was, and Dr. No says, "You wouldn't want to break that bottle. It's an exquisite 58
Dom Perignon."
Yeah, and his reply is, "I prefer the 53 myself,"
which is such a great line
because Bond knows wine.
Absolutely.
No, Bond knows alcohol. Yeah, no, it's this wonderful scene where Dr. No, who is a white guy in yellow face.
Well, he was the son of a German missionary and
a Chinese guy.
A
Chinese lady. And he becomes part of the Tang?
Yeah, the Tong.
Tong.
Isn't it?
The Tong Gang, which is like
syndicate, yeah.
Like the triads, but Chinese. It's
mafia. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he betrays them, stealing $12 million worth of gold.
I like how he was so specific to tell us that he was the treasurer of them.
Yes.
Like, well, okay, that's good to know. Thanks.
But the line before that is Bond's like, the girl doesn't need to be here. She doesn't know to know of these things. And Dr. No's like, you're right. And she's like, I want to stay. And they're like, no, you must leave. And so they just take her away, apparently to rape her.
He says specifically she'll entertain the guards or something like that.
The guards will entertain her. Yeah.
And they're just like, this is a rape scene. And Bond is not okay. And that's when he grabs the champagne.
Well, he didn't do that just out of like gentlemanly whatever. He grabbed the knife while he was acting all harumph.
Oh, true.
And Dr. No sees it.
Yeah. And Dr. No calls him out on it. He's like, just put down the knife. You're being stupid. Come on.
Yeah.
You didn't think I saw this coming a mile away.
Which presumably is to show just how quote unquote smart Dr. No is. Like he's a genius or something that
nothing
he can see
him.
Bond pick up a knife.
But then we cut to Bond getting the ever loving piss beaten out of him. And
which doesn't happen often enough.
Ooh, and they also establish that he has crazy robot hands, apparently.
Dr. No.
Yes.
Dr. No picks this little statuette, little bronze statuette off the table and then crushes it.
Right. Amazing for the 60s, right? Like those prosthetics.
Yeah.
And does it really come into it at all?
No, you thought it would. And it's referenced because something Ian Fleming does, at least in the books and in some of the early movies especially, there's a mixture of all the villains have to have something about them. And like the other example that comes immediately to mind is Scaramanga with the third nipple.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And there's also something always weird about them. And I mean, yes, he's the Asian genius type. So he had, well, and something I want to put out here too, of course, is the Chinese bit. So they're all wearing pseudo Mao suits the whole time, and everyone's dressed identically, which is weird.
Because it's communist?
Question mark.
China?
Everything question mark. Yeah. Everything here gets a question mark. But ultimately, Dr. No has this kind of weirdness to him. Unlike some later ones where they're like kind of homosexual, so that makes them the villain. Here he has a deformity where he messed around with radiation so much that he has robot hands now, which can crush anything.
Yep.
But he can't shake Bond's hand because he really can't control them. And even when he's holding things like that cigarette holder, it's kind of like barely squeezed, but like two chopsticks between his fingers that are kind of half in control all the time.
Like someone placed it there for him.
Which is also something that they make fun of in Austin Powers, which I keep making fun of, where the robot hands keep grabbing at people's neck, right? Like, you can't really control it. Or Dr. Strangelove, even, which keeps going into the Nazi salute. Like, it's this amazing robot hands can't control them. Whoops! Kind of question mark to it. But Bond gets the ever-loving piss beaten out of him, right? And ends up in this weird capital letter A shaped like a prison cell where it's slanted walls with a window and a door like midway up, and then on the wall is this one window.
And actually, I want to take a step back to he gets the ever-loving crap beat out of him, that we actually see him with bruises, with blood. Like, he looks like he had the crap beat out of him. Whereas in subsequent movies, especially the most recent ones, he can be wailed on, he could have like things crack his ribs and whatever, and he just gets up and walks it off. Even in the most recent movie, he had like needles jabbed into his brain, and he just shrugs it off and starts shooting people.
Yeah.
This one, he's got bruises, he's got wounds.
Well, and he limps for a half a second, Inspector. Here he's like really like, and it's funny, the later cliches, especially Pierce Brosnan in like The World Is Not Enough, he ends up underwater for half a second, and while he's underwater, he adjusts his tie and comes out with his hair slicked back. Here, Sean is not wearing a wig yet. We're on a first-name basis. You know, Sean. Still has his normal hair. It's slicked back in this great 1960s way. But, like, he'll fix his hair, but it's not back to Bond.
Yeah.
Like, he half falls asleep on the beach at one point, and it looks like he slept with Brill Cream in his hair. Like, and here, like, he gets the crap beat out of him. He ends up underwater on top of whatever. He pulls his hair back so it's out of his eyes, because it's long to have it as slick back as he does. But it's not neat ever again. And I really appreciate that, because Bond, like John said, gets the ever-loving crap beaten out of him and ends up bloody and bruised and swollen. That blood stays around for the rest of the movie. He ends up beaten and has scars, and fine. It works. It makes sense. Until he has sex later in the movie. But that's another scene for another day. So Bond is in this prison cell. His weird kind of, I don't even know, it's like a Nehru jacket. It buttons all the way to the top, and it has like a cropped collar midway up. It looks like a stereotypical Asian outfit from the 1960s. Go figure. He sees this kind of ventilation grill, and he reaches for it and gets immediately electrocuted and thrown against the wall of his cell, grabbing his hands, putting them in like he burned himself severely, takes a shoe off, beats it against the grill, and it's been deactivated. It's the worst security system ever, because
it's electrified, but you can just kind of push it out of the way.
It's electrified once. I get the feeling you shorted out the system, and they're like, whoops, that's it. You got it. You beat me. If you survive that as a full-grown man, you're fine. Then the movie turns into Die Hard, like we said earlier, 26 years earlier or whatever. He's crawling through these great vents. They're huge. They're tubular.
And they apparently are for air and also water.
Like,
it's obviously an air vent in the prison cell, because there's a grate that just leads into the prison cell.
And eventually leads into another prison cell.
But if it fills up with water, wouldn't everything flood? So I'm assuming they just have water going through part of it, but not other parts of it, which seems highly irregular from an HVAC standpoint.
I'm not going to argue with you, because it's so Bond, again, this couldn't look more like Die Hard, in fact, because he's wearing this torn undershirt that's bloody, and like it really does look like what Bruce Willis is wearing in those scenes, right? And he's crawling through this ribbed for her pleasure tube system. He comes across this pit, like this vent that goes down, and I literally turned to Matt and I'm like, well, I guess that's a dead end. And no, he crawls down and falls the last 20 feet. You hear this thud, this metal hollow thud as he bruises another rib or whatever. And then there's this water. You see, he turns around, there's water coming, and he braces himself as though, well, this is only going to last a few seconds. He survives it. Ends up finding then what? Help me out here. He ends up in the main room.
Yeah,
in the
contamination room, I think.
He comes out exactly where he needs to be.
Yeah,
he finds a guard that's just sort of hanging
around. Luckily, his height, too.
Right, hanging around in his little radiation suit, who he sneaks up behind and gives him a chokehold.
Behind some tempered glass.
Right. And they go down as like a silhouette, and then next thing you see him, he's in the radiation suit, and he's blending right in.
He's blending right in, despite the fact that he's a head taller than everyone else in this movie, except for Dr. No.
Walking around looking at all the files like, oh, over here. Yes.
I'm busy.
My job.
And so we pan to the actual plot,
mm-hmm.
which is Dr. No trying to disrupt whatever Gemini or Mercury mission this is. And Felix Leiter at the top says, you have 48 hours before we have to launch. I'm going to send the Marines. And he goes, you get your Marines. But I get the first 12 hours. But apparently it's 3 days later now because the actual rocket launch is happening. Fine. And Sir Sean is, like Mark was saying, is blending in, grabbing files, reading them casually, ends up 6 inches away from Dr. No, who doesn't notice him at all.
And who makes the comment, like, hey, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're not at your post. Like, get up on that gantry.
Where's Chang? Oh, he's right behind us. Chang, get over there. Do your thing.
That just happens. They have, like, all these people working on these, like...
This is a nuclear facility, and he's just wandering around.
Right, and it's apparently just lowering the control rods directly into the cooling pool, like, right there.
Oh, yeah. Right there. Right there.
Well, and that's a question
how you
mark.
Set things up, right?
Because, like, what is the point of this room? Is it to destroy the world? Is it to deal with the nuclear power? Because it seems like those should be two separate rooms.
It's an open system reactor that also is used for, taking down rockets.
I feel like there are better ways to handle nuclear material.
You just have a big pool in the middle of the room,
and then you throw a desk next to it. You're good.
You're good.
Well, it's just that easy.
Well, and I want to know at the time, because, like, I know who the actor's name is, Joseph Wiseman, who plays Dr. No, who's a white guy playing a half-Chinese, half-German guy. But the reason I bring it up is he the biggest actor in the film at the time? Because Sean Connery, I mean, I believe he's a younger actor. This is 50 years ago. But the reason I ask is everyone in this is wearing these opaque radiation suits that I believe are radiation suits because they're opaque. Like, they probably are lead-lined. You make sense. Fine. Dr. No is at this point wearing a completely see-through. And I'm not saying it's tempered. It's not tempered in any way. You can see his whole body sitting there, and you're like, is this because he's so famous you want to make sure you see his face the whole time?
I think it's more that they wanted to make sure you knew who the bad guy was. Because with everyone wearing the same thing,
could be that.
You couldn't tell.
But what about the other guy on the gantry, who apparently is the only henchman ever who gets the see-through suit too, right?
The bubble suit.
There's one other guy.
Yeah.
Who's there turning a...
You'd think he would have, like, the most heavy-duty suit.
Because he's the one actually
everyone.
Manipulating the radiation.
Right,
he's
above standing, the radiation. Right.
Yeah. 6 feet below him are the actual...
The rods! This is the... This scene is the craziest interpretation, because it's technically correct. You raise and lower things into water to make steam, to make nuclear power. Like, there's
a... They show other henchmen doing the, like... The remote arm thing that, like, Homer Simpson does, like, and, like, another thing behind some glass. So I'm like, if you've got that, what the hell are you doing?
They're doing it in the same room,
too. Like, wheeling it up and wheeling it down. You're just like, this is not safe. He's just in a suit.
You could not have put that knob anywhere else, Nick. Anywhere else. It would have been too far.
And the kill switch on the other side that he tries to reach for before Bond throws him away? Yeah, okay, so...
Basic safety parameters not followed for this construction.
This is 61. There isn't OSHA yet. It's totally right. Fine at that point. I like Spectre's version of OSHA. And it's a tentacle wearing safety goggles. I'm like, the octopus has goggles on and it's waving its tentacle at you. That's
well,
great.
He did give the... he gave Dent, if I may go back, about... 30
Half
minutes
an hour
of the movie. He gives him, like, the spider in the cage, and he's just sort of like, here's a spider in the cage.
Oh, we can talk about the tarantula.
Nudge, nudge. And, yeah, nowadays, it's like a tarantula. It's like a 12-year-old, like, boy's like, oh, I've got a spider as a pet. It's so cool. So everybody kind of knows, okay, it's a tarantula.
Yeah.
It can bite you. It would suck, but it's not going to kill you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, filler. Dent's supposed to kill Bond. He fails the first time with snipers who get interrupted by a taxi which drives by. So the way to kill Bond is to put a tarantula in his sheets. And you literally see it crawling up his leg like an erection. And then all of a sudden, there's this great scene where you see it come out of the sheets, and there's clearly two people in this scene. One is the trainer who just has, like, a burly shoulder, much burlier than Sean Connery's, by the way.
Right.
And a semi-like hairy chest. And you see the spider crawling up his arm. And then the other one is Sean Connery freaking out under a piece of glass, mm-hmm. going like looking like this, and the spider is crawling in a way that's clearly not touching him in any way. Because by the time Bond freaks out, he's still like this, and it's on the pillow, but it's not on the pillow. The pillow's not dead.
Well above the pillow.
and it brings up something John mentioned earlier, which we forgot, is how bad the theme fits into this movie. Because... Well, the movie is 90% completely silent as far as background sounds go. It really is. There's no background music. And then all of a sudden, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da will flare up as Bond walks, say, through the hallway in a hotel, walking to the concierge desk to pick up the phone. And it will just go da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
And yet killing Dr. No is completely silent.
But and killing that spider with a shoe gets the most dramatic music, because Sean...
That was my favorite part. He uses an actual shoe, just, like I do.
No cue gadgets on this. It's a shoe.
I was really hoping he would take out the Walter and just, like, unload on the spider.
Because Sean... You get the feeling there was actually a spider, and Sean was freaking out. Because he's just like, wham, 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 and the music is swearing.
And I thought that one filled in on the protracted attempt to kill Bond.
Yes.
That was the first one. I thought it was great.
It was the most protracted of all. Other than someone throwing a snake later on. We'll get to that.
Sorry.
No, you're right to bring that up, because that scene stuck out as a sore thumb. It wasn't even a sore thumb. It was as though we needed someone to try to kill Bond in a clever way. A spider. But it wasn't even a spider in the bed. Dent has to go to Dr. No and be like, we couldn't get him. And this is a scene about 15 years ago, or 10 years ago. I went to visit a buddy of mine in New York, and at MoMA they had this Salvador Dali exhibit, and how Salvador Dali had done scenes for Alfred Hitchcock. You know, dream sequences, these weird long angles and oddly shaped things. That's what this scene reminded me of, because Dent goes and visits him, and it's this weird concrete room with this skylight that's this grid, and so there's this weird shadow across in the corner. There's this one chair that looks like it's out of The Nightmare Before Christmas, and it's weird Dutch angles. And again, Dent is a tall, kind of slim guy, and Dr. No's like, have a seat, Professor Dent. And he sits down, and he's like a little kid with his hands under his knees sitting in this chair. And he's like, you have failed me once before, but go to the table. And this tarantula in a cage. And this looks like a bird cage out of a Looney Tunes.
It's a really poorly designed cage, because I was thinking about it, like, if that spider just wanted to walk up to it, it could walk through those bars.
Yeah. Right.
Which is what made me think of it in terms of OSHA, where they're just like, apparently this is a deadly spider. We'll overlook the fact that tarantulas aren't really all that dangerous, right? And, okay, this spider could kill someone. And
right.
We're just putting it in this little bamboo cage, just sort of...
It's in a grade C cage.
it's the way that, like, in other movies from the 70s and 80s, it'll just be a snake. But it's a garden snake. It's green. But they're like, oh my god, it's poisonous! And like, holding it away like it's going
to
kill them.
And if you put any dangerous animal in a room with a sleeping person, it will go to that person and try to kill them.
Fact.
Literally, fact. But yeah, no, that's the most protracted way to kill Bond possibly ever.
Like how Den later did the direct approach and just, let's just shoot him.
Yeah.
Go ahead. He fails, but at least
he's
direct.
Gets in trouble for the other guys who were going to shoot him, but oh no, a car went by. So, we'll just go home.
Tried.
What do you want me to do? Try again?
But let's wrap this up, because we're so close to the end of this. And then we jump forward with something we forgot, which is important, because of protracted death scenes, like, Goldfinger has him strapped to a table with a laser beam. This guy puts a tarantula in a sheet which crawls up his leg. long story short, they're trying to interrupt this launch, and you see one of the most clearly model of all models. I'm not saying, like, sexy lady model. I'm talking about, like, this is a small-scale model with, like, little animatronic, like, servos going, like, and a little, the smallest of satellite dishes comes up, like, we're going to stop this Cape Canaveral launch of this rocket. And Bond's like, well, I've heard enough. And he just starts throwing dials and switches. He beats up the guy who's throwing this giant turny thing.
Well, he turns the wheel on the danger meter, which goes as one of you guys pointed out, from 0 to 50, where 25 is, oh shit. Like,
he turns it all the way up to 75.
Right.
Out of 50, he turns it up to 75. And the guy who had already taken one hard punch to the jaw tries to reach up to hit the kill switch, and Bond's like, oh no, and throws him off into ? Because he hits water, which I figured was where the... like was the cooling pond underneath the radioactive yeah. element. But we don't see it. It never cuts back to that. So it's just maybe a random pond.
Who knows?
There's a well, and then Lassie shows up and points out that little Timmy fell into that well.
Which also, the one random henchman goes for the kill switch, which felt very like, not so much, oh no, he's going to foil the plot, more like, you idiot, what are you doing? You're going to kill us all, because there's an active nuclear reactor beneath our feet, literally.
But that's how kind of Dr. No handles it at first, but then ultimately he realized, oh, it's Sean Connery. Someone needs to explain the end of this, because I got baffled. After that happens, and the rocket actually launches successfully...
Well, I guess what he does is he... When he's turning the wheel, it pulls the control rods out of the cooling pond.
So they go into meltdown or whatever.
Yeah, he has the tussle with Dr. No, who comes by to try to physically stop him, which, to his credit, none of his henchmen do. They just get the hell out of Dodge.
Did no one have a gun?
No,
literally no one had a gun.
No one had a gun.
Which I guess makes sense. Why would you arm people in a nuclear reactor? But fine.
And they have a tussle, and he knocks him into the cooling pond, which at that point...
Henchman.
Bond knocks Dr. No.
Bond knocks Dr. No, yeah.
On top of the pile, they have a tussle on top of the control rod assembly that's going up and down, which is... I mean, if he's not going to get killed by the alcoholism or getting
tremendously
shot
irradiated.
Or the STDs, yeah, he's going to get cancer at some point now. But
thank God he's Sean Connery, so in 1989 he'll drink from the Ark of the become immortal.
But he knocks Dr. No into the boiling hot cooling pond, which kills him. And then Bond gets the hell out of there, and the whole place goes up.
So when I was a kid, I watched a movie called Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Fine. And they make fun of Sir Lancelot running up a hill continuously. And then every time you cut back to the guards, he's back down the hill running up it again and running up it again. That's what Dr. No does. He's reaching up for dear life, and you just see these leather-clad hands clawing at the side of the scaffolding. And then the cross-cut, the two-shot, is this crossbeam. And then another crossbeam, as though he could literally grab onto it. A man who's so strong he can crush bronze with his hand couldn't pull himself up on an iron scaffolding. But we keep seeing him clawing to the point where there's claw marks shown in the side of these beams as he's drowning in this radioactive pond. This is, on one hand, both the most successful and laziest death of a Spectre lead type ever. It's amazing.
And it's quick, too. It just takes a couple seconds and he's suddenly gone.
He drowns in 10 seconds. It's the laziest death of a tall, strong man ever.
And silent.
And silent.
There's no background music. Right?
No.
No.
He is being boiled, though, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but he's in a radioactive suit. You think he...
It's really hot,
radiation
though.
Suit, rather.
Yeah, but, I mean, like... Thermal.
Doesn't Bond's foot go in it for half a second, or am I crazy?
They would all be in serious trouble in that room. Yeah. I mean, it would not be good.
No, I'm not arguing. It's just one of these things. It's an interesting Bond end to the villain. Bond knows Spectre exists. He doesn't understand it yet, right? Like, this is going to set up the next four movies. Because by 1971, due to lawsuits, which we'll get into, they can't talk about Spectre again. But at the time, Spectre makes sense, right? It's this really creepy... And, you know, John and I were talking about it earlier. I thought it referenced Marx, Karl Marx, who says there's a Spectre across Europe, right? And it refers to communism. But this, in some ways, we talked about the acronym earlier, it's not that. Right? It's just, we're going to screw with both sides. Fine. Whatever. Who cares? Question mark. I don't know. But it's this great introduction to a secretive organization. And it's interesting, and it makes sense, that he dies. Because otherwise, there'd be this interrogation scene. We don't get the interrogation scene. He dies. He dies, you know, he fights to the last, so to speak. Which makes sense. However... Everyone else is jumping desperately from this weird island/platform, steel platform thing, which looks like an oil derrick in the middle of the desert. Fine. Everyone's trying to get away. Bond gets away because he beats up these two people on a little...
Dinghy
thing with a motor. He punches out one. The other one he literally throws overboard. Then the one that's unconscious he leaves to drown or gets sucked into the propeller of his motorboat. And he goes away with Honey. About... Then we have a cold cut. Like a salami on a sandwich.
Yum.
They come to. Bond pulls out this, like, dipstick. And he goes, well, I guess we're out of oil. Or out of gasoline.
Which makes no sense.
Well, I think we know what he's doing here. He's pulling that old trick.
No gasoline.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
And then he gets to sleep with woman number three. Yeah. And then Felix Leiter, who comes back and cocks blocks. I want
to... With the British Navy.
I think it's the Marines, right?
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't know.
They're flying British colors. I want to ask you just here, quick stop. How do you think Jack Lord did as Felix Leiter?
I think he was...
So people who are listening, I'm going to ask about all the money pennies, all the M's, all the Felix Leiters, all the Q's, unfortunately, because once Desmond Loyal is introduced, he's there until Pierce, and then we have R, and then he dies, unfortunately. But I think it's important because these are the standard characters who keep showing up. I think Jack Lord did fine.
I think he was a good introduction to the character. I mean, he's never the most colorful character in the series. I mean, he's a CIA operative, and he does what CIA operatives do.
I think the most recent one, the one under Daniel Craig, is great.
Yes.
But frankly, I prefer him as suave and debonair to Jack Wade, played by Jordan Baker under the Pierce movies.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Mark, I interrupted you. What were you going to think?
No, I thought he was good. I thought it kind of struck me that... I felt like he did more than a lot of other Felix Leiters who were just sort of there for that one scene to,
yeah.
Hey, maybe you should check this out, and then that's it. Or he's on the periphery, but there. And he was actually sort of an active participant in this, even though he kind of gets waved away at the last excursion.
Yeah.
And I don't know. But I thought it was interesting. I also found out, researching this stuff, that... that actor didn't come back because he wanted more money and he wanted higher billing. Mm-hmm. He was apparently thinking it was going to go in the direction of James Bond and Felix Leiter as some sort of
duo.
Like a two-hander, I guess. Yeah.
Which you could kind of see from this movie, but would be weird thinking about.
Well, and it's one of these things, like they mentioned it more recently, where you have such good actors wanting to play Felix Leiter. I mean, you know, the thing is, with Die Another Day, you end up with Jinx, who's such a terrible CIA operative, and they so badly wanted a spinoff that failed. Here, Felix matters. Like, he really does. Like, he helps out. And you could almost imagine filming a parallel Dr. No movie, where he's the guy in the Caribbean dealing with this stuff.
He does seem to know more about what's going on than Bond does.
And Bond really is improvising as he goes. Felix is the one who's planning stuff out.
And he's got a network in place.
Yes.
Through all the various people in Jamaica who actually know what's going on.
He just doesn't have the same strategy that Bond has, which is basically, I know this is a trap, I know that this is whatever, but I'll just go anyway and see how it turns out.
Something
Felix somehow, as CIA, managed to get the British Marines or the British Navy to come on anyway. Just because?
It's CIA. Like, I mean, I totally buy that in the 60s where it's like, it's not even NATO really yet. It's just like, you're our allies. We need to get out of this.
Yeah.
Fine, whatever. But then we end up with the end. I don't know if Bond ends up more movies in a boat, a plane, or in some sort of life raft. But at the end, he's going to be with a woman.
I think in an aquatic setting is very popular. Yes. For less.
And, you know, it might just be because, like, of this movie.
Maybe.
Frankly. But regardless, at the end of the day, what ends up happening is he ends up in this little, like you said, like a dinghy. It's like a little motorboat, the simplest of motorboats, that have run out of gas. Felix shows up with the British Marines, and they're like, do you need a lift? And he's like, fine. He's about to make out with her then. And then all of a sudden, they're being towed away, and he slowly lets go of the tow rope. And then we have the end, with the and end on either side of the boat kind of drifting out to sea. So we've survived Dr. No. What do you guys get? Let's go around the horn. Final thoughts. Mark, what do you think? Would you watch this again? Is this one that someone who is getting into Bond should watch? And then just overall, does this movie hold up? Is it a good film?
I think so. I really like the sort of base spycraft kind of stuff. I like the hair on the door to see if anybody's come in. I like all the radio transmissions, and we check in every so often. If somebody doesn't check in, then we know that something's up. We're gonna send someone out. It felt a lot more like it was an actual sort of believable. You get a mission for this, rather than something crazy and off the wall, which is fun in its own way. But I think it's neat to have that underpinning that could kind of carry forward, I guess. Excellent. So yeah.
Yeah, no, it's fair. Matt, what do you think?
I mean, I'll definitely watch it again. And I think, I mean, that's not a fair question to ask. I'll watch any Bond movie again because I like them. But this is not in my list of top movies. As I said, I'd only seen it once or twice. It would definitely be something that you should watch maybe after you've seen some of the other ones. I mean, it does introduce the character, but you don't really need an introduction to the character, to be really honest. But it's good to go back and see what they were trying to do with it. So,
fair enough. John?
It's fun to see where a lot of the standard Bond things came from, because this introduces a lot of them, and you can tell that this is version one of many of the things, like the car or the girl or the gadgets or things like that. This is where they were introducing it and experimenting with it. Even the intro sequence, they had an extended intro sequence, which was fairly common at the time, but Bond played around with it. And as far as in the rankings of Bond films, it's good to see from that perspective, but I'd say it's far down the list because the plot makes no sense, and it's really just to serve to introduce the characters.
Well, I don't know. I think it's still a really good movie.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say it's really far down the list, but I don't know. We'll
there are certainly worse films.
Yes.
I will give you that. There are way worse films. But, I mean, I think it just goes to introduce everybody, and that's its main purpose.
Well, I mean, we're making notes the whole time. We'll end up probably – I mean, my idea is by the end, by the time we get to Spectre next fall – or next winter – yeah, it's that far out – you will be able to give us not only, John's ranking, Mark and Matt and Nick's ranking, but ultimately our average ranking from beginning to end. Because we can do that. We're going to be able to talk about everything in order. That's the idea of doing this. We'll rank everything from the gadgets to the cars to whatever. As far as my thoughts go on this, I'm on one hand baffled and one hand completely enjoyable. As far as introducing a new character that is iconic, I'm shocked. At the top, I was asking, if this was not a Bond movie, would people watch it? It's an interesting 1960s spy movie. It's paced like a 1960s movie. The number of actual action scenes are very small. And a lot of the time when they cut to things like explosions or big dramatic set pieces, it's in miniature. It really feels like a classic movie. Would it stand out if it weren't James Bond? Probably not. I mean, the 60s presented us things like The Manchurian Candidate and, actual spy and heist films. Although I do appreciate that here that Bond actually has to act like a spy, which he doesn't actually often. He's sent to figure out what happened in Jamaica and figures it out. It's not like he's – when we get to Goldfinger, he just happens to be at the same hotel where Goldfinger is and stumbles into a plot. Whoops, he's on vacation. This actually matters, and he's sent in as a 00 agent.
And I guess it should be noted that when he's initially sent in, they don't think it's a big thing.
No.
One of their guys went missing, and they sent him to go figure it out. And it turns out to be a big thing.
And that's the difference between sending in an average person versus a 00. He tracks it up the line, right? That's the idea. He's James Bond. He deserves – you send him on a mission, he'll figure it out. you know, at the end of the day, like Matt was saying, I can see where the stereotypes come from and where they're desperately trying to find a formula. But if I'm Ian Fleming or I'm, you know, the director, and I'm like, well, we have a movie that there's a bunch of background material. Is this going to be Harry Potter where we make 9 movies? Or is this going to be a spinoff where we can't make a sequel? Fine. We'll see. This has as many of the parts of their repeated books as possible. I think they come out successfully. Now, if you're trying to get a friend into Bond, this is not where I would start.
No.
You know, there's a lot of better movies, but you know, this one has a 96% on Rotten Tomatoes. I can see why. In 1961, this is a movie where things happen and it's enjoyable. It's paced very slowly, and frankly, watching Spectre, it's paced much more like a classic 60s Bond than it is, say, GoldenEye or Casino Royale, where there's a lot of action. This is very slow, and it builds and it builds and it builds, and by the time you get to the base, you're at a point of tension. Fine. I enjoyed this movie. It's one of the first ones I watched on DVD when I got the DVD, because I'm like, this is where it all began. I think we're all on that part of the agreement. At the end of the day, though, this is one that people who get into Bond will go back to. I don't think if you're not into Bond, this is probably one you can fairly skip.
Yeah.
However, we're just about out of time, and I think we've beat this movie to death. Every time we do this, if you're listening to the Myopia feed, next week will be a classic Myopia episode. And the thing about a Myopia episode, it'll be about something random, something light, something enjoyable. If you're not into Myopia or, you know, remembering your childhood, don't get me wrong, sometimes trauma happens. Tune in every other week. This will come out bi-weekly, or if you're following us on our standard feed, Mission Briefing has its own feed on iTunes. Enjoy it. It will only be Mission Briefing. But you should check out Myopia. It's what the rest of us do. We like Mission Briefing, but we definitely like Myopia. Where else are you going to get to talk about Mighty Ducks? Don't answer that. However, next week, excuse me, in 2 weeks rather, tune in as we talk about From Russia with Love, because Mission Briefing will return with From Russia from Love. Thanks, guys.
Mission Briefing and Myopia Defend Your Childhood are produced by Dude Letter Podcasting. It's hosted and edited by Nick Hoffman. Our graphic designer is Scott Miller. The theme song is sampled from Monty Norman's James Bond theme. Questions and comments? Please visit myopiapodcast.com/missionbriefing or contact us through myopiamissionbriefing@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter @missionbriefing and @myopiapodcast, and find us on Facebook, Stitcher, and iTunes. And while you're on iTunes, please rate and review our podcast. Want to help us out? Go to myopiapodcast.com/Amazon and purchase stuff like normal. Myopia and Mission Briefing get a piece of the action.
James Bond will return in From Russia with Love.